Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear this program and many other wonderful programs at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Big Brother is Watching. Heidi Bogosian talks about government surveillance, corporate power, and public resistance with Robert Scheer.
I'm no fan, but Sister Sarah Palin teaches us to call it the lamestream media. I think she had a point, and I do get a lot of information from the alternative media. My name is John Turek. I'm part of the Oakland Privacy Working Group. We're actually trying to stop the Joint Domain Awareness Center that the city government wants to put in place, which involves not only the rationale now is crime. It was designed initially to stop terrorist attacks on the Port of Oakland. The city council is taking money from the Department of Homeland Security for a contractor by the name of SAIC, that is known in the industry, I understand, as NSA West, to do, you know, real-time surveillance of the citizens and residents of the city of Oakland. Now, Oakland, as you know, was involved in the Occupy movement, and we had about 10%. We're the 47th largest city in the country, but we had about 10% of the Occupy-related arrests here. Mm-hmm. My question is, in the context of the work against this Domain Awareness Center, and this is directed to you, Ms. Bogosian, what kinds of citizen or resident organizing are you aware of around the country against the development of these kinds of anti-crime, and also in Oakland's case, explicitly political surveillance uses of these technologies?
What an important effort you're undertaking locally. I'm not aware of that much organizing around the country. I'm interested in that, though. I know SAIC gets a lot of money, a lot of grants, and makes up threat assessments in order to justify that funding. I mean, the individuals involved in it admit our community applied for these grants. We had to fabricate, and I have a few examples of some of the things they made up. They're ludicrous. They're laughable. So kudos to you, and I'd be interested in, I'll try to find out what's happening more. Thank you.
I had three quick questions. I'll make them really fast. One was, I read about Dilma Rousseff of Brazil talking about uniting with other countries to route fiber optics somewhere else. Is that a pipe dream? Is that even feasible to route that outside the U.S., which would defeat the intelligence gathering capacity of NSA? And my second question would be, how do you combat this tide of amongst the young, particularly, to not value privacy? You know, we go from the extremes of someone my father's age who, if someone came to the door, called him on the phone, asked him a question, would say, "Who wants to know?" And why?
Right.
To someone, younger people just voluntarily give everything. So how do you how do you educate people on a massive scale? And then the third thing, I'm not sure people are so aware of how much misinformation. When you aggregate so much information, no doubt they can target a single individual if they want to a terrifying degree. But most of the information is inaccurate. Like, I'm a private investigator. I have access to database aggregators. And, for example, if there's someone named Roberta Scheer who lived on a street that you lived on, not even the same address, 15 years ago in L.A., you could come up with the aggregate. It'll show three evictions and several failure to appears for, you know, traffic violations. And it'll come up if I enter your name. So I don't think people realize the amount of information that they're going to have to slog through to try and clear their name up.
Wait a minute. Well, I think the first question is a really important one. And I think this Brazilian example is key, but it's not just Brazil. It's China. It's everywhere. There's a recognition that our multinational corporations are protected by a nation state, and that they may be multinational in other ways, but there's a parochial concern and preoccupation, and there is a recognition that there has to be other areas of control and independence. And I think the Snowden revelations, I mean, they applied to Germany and other places, were very important. And if these companies want to retain their position, particularly the carriers and so forth, they're going to have to shape up, and they're going to have to take on their own government. So I think we're in a period, I hate to be too optimistic, where we become a normal nation. And I think if we can make that transition where we're a normal nation, we're not the center of the world, we're not the city on the hill, we don't have to control everything, it gives us a lot more room to become a more sensible nation and take care of our own people and so forth. It concerns wages and jobs and all sorts of things, and that we may find alliances in our own country that we didn't have before. I think the opposition to going to war in Syria was a good example of that. Do you want to take the other
question? I'll take the second question, how to remind or educate young people especially that there are other options. One thing that struck me a few months ago, I was walking by a local community garden in the East Village in New York where I live, and there was an old sign that said something like 15 ways to reclaim community. And it had things like, you know, say hi to a stranger on the street, open a door for someone, some basic things. But I think that when you read in the mainstream news media or elsewhere about an example of someone, for example, who takes a chance and maybe, you know, we have some subway incidents in New York where someone will jump down and help someone, and that person's proclaimed a hero. And I think people love to latch on to those things because of the emotional value that it puts us back in touch with how important humanity is, and one-on-one reaching out and going outside of yourself to connect with someone else. So I would urge families to keep teaching young people that it's important to think beyond the ego, think of your neighborhood, your community, and again, don't let the corporations and an empire-seeking government tell us how to spend every hour of our days. Do something different. Take a chance. Have some fun. You know, there's a group in New York that I mention in my chapter on spying on critical mass, and I know critical mass is big in San Francisco. Well, the one in New York is pretty much dissolved because they were so infiltrated by police. But one little bicycle group called Time's Up, they're an environmental group, and they still go out on their bikes dressed as polar bears, and they, you know, have like a love day where people ride over the Brooklyn Bridge in the winter and they serve hot chocolate. I mean, these creative things, be it in a protest or just for the fun of it, strike a chord in people because it's human. It's not a corporation, and I think that's very important. And the last question about misinformation, you reminded me of one thing we didn't talk about, and that's even with the RFID chip. So say you have a book with an RFID chip in it, and I give it to Robert, but I purchased it. So not only does he have my book, but they know that he connected with me, so it can track patterns of association. But again, in a vacuum, information, just as you say, when they gather things without the complete picture, it's so easy to have erroneous information. And there's a huge danger. It stays that way because we can't correct it exactly. It's something people should be aware of.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I just want to give one little answer to that. I do think the ball game is the empire versus the republic. And I think that the gap between, say, what the multinational, take wages and jobs. If our definition of an ideal corporation is General Electric, that now has 2 out of 3 jobs abroad, no longer makes light bulbs, they have GE Capital. If it's Apple that has these jobs basically abroad, low wages and so forth. If the whole notion of your community is increasing income inequality and a nation state that basically has military clout to protect your overseas interests, what you end up is a large alienated population at home. Chris Hedges has a very good piece on Truthdig now saying this is where we're going to get our resistance from. And I see the main trap here is that a lot of people making the decisions are careerists. The main thing we teach in our universities is how do you become a successful careerist. If you can get into the better law schools, if you can get the better position, you get the toys, you can take care of your family and your extended family. But if you're not in that league, you don't have that particular skill or what's what, you're a loser. in the society. Well, this is a different America than I was raised in. My relatives who, some of them had, have a high school degree, many of them still had a good life, still had a place. Well, if we no longer have that kind of society, we're going to have a lot of dislocation. So the real issue becomes, what is your community? And what is your responsibility to that community? And the distraction from that is empire, it's war, it's patriotism, it's all that sort of thing. But if you get back to what is your community, well, you get back to all sorts of things, including privacy, including respect for the other. And I think that is the big battle now, to my concern. And that's why I keep stressing, challenging the military-industrial complex and challenging. Because I think if we got rid of that, or could keep that at bay, I think common sense will prevail. I think most people do not want to be spied on. They don't want all this information. They want their privacy. It's not just your father or grandfather. I think it's a normal human instinct to be left alone, to be able to find your own friendship, right? I mean, I think we have a desire for that. And then we'll only buy products that enhance that rather than, so we won't shop at Macy's if they can track us. And that will become a news story. And people will be shocked by it, I think, And let me ask you a question, by the way. We're here in Berkeley. Did I miss it? But did we not pick the person who was in charge of Homeland Security to be head of the UC system? Did I miss something? I mean, since when? I remember a day when Clark Kerr was held as an object of suspicion because he had some Defense Department credential. How come this came and went without anybody raising a question? Student body, but I mean, that's absurd training to be head of the biggest university system in the country, that you were involved in suppressing freedom and frightening people. I wanted to say that tonight. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that, because I was actually was intrigued by your question or your comment about why lawyers aren't outraged being a lawyer. My name is Sharon Adams, and I'm with the National Lawyers Guild also. And I was thinking about the famous lawyer that resides at Berkeley Law School, John Yoo, who actually, in addition to being the writer of the torture memos, was actually the first author of the president's surveillance program. He's the first person to have actually created the surveillance program that we're now so aware of. And I just have to share this because many people have heard the story about John Ashcroft's bedside and James Comey and the stand at the bedside. Well, that was about the president's surveillance program written by John Yoo. And John Yoo alone was the one that initially authorized warrantless wiretapping on U.S. citizens. So actually, even though that was somewhat of a statement, I would like a comment about what it means that we have people like John Yoo teaching the next generation of elite lawyers, and as you pointed out, Napolitano now as the president. So I'd like just to get both of your comment on that.
Well, Michael Avery, a former Guild president, has written a book this year on the Federalist Society. And the Federalist Society, which operates often in secrecy, has really done an excellent job of mentoring young law students. Its first chapter, I think, was at Yale Law School. But it's been heavily funded really has changed the landscape, the legal and political landscape in this country over the last three decades because they've written thousands of amicus brief, friend of the court briefs, sponsored what they call sort of intellectual legal debates on campuses and elsewhere, where they invite liberals to debate them, but they've very cleverly moved young conservative attorneys into judicial clerkships, corporate law firms, positions of power, federal judicial positions, and influenced some of the major Supreme Court decisions and really shifted the landscape to the right. So I think that's a factor in how we have the individuals you mentioned interpreting the laws, including with the FISA courts and everything we see to facilitate a growing surveillance apparatus. Well, the Olin Foundation gives them a lot of money and other organizations. I would recommend, if you're interested, well, there's some good articles on the Federalist Society online, and there's the book. It's called, I think, How Conservatives Took Back the Law from the Left. by Michael Avery, but that's been a factor. And under the early Bush administration and Reagan administration, they really took hold.
I just do want to put it, I don't want to kick anybody out of teaching. I do believe in academic freedom, and I don't mind that there's this professor or that professor. I think you should have the ability to challenge them, take them on. That, to my mind, is not the problem. The problem is not this lawyer or that lawyer. It's the law schools. It's the business schools. Where have they been? What do they teach? Do they have ethics classes? As far as I can see, I mean, look, I spoke at the Kennedy Center last year at Harvard, and my opening question was, how did this place, not the Kennedy Center, Harvard, get to be such a den of iniquity? If you look at really the terrible things that have been done in this country, it's not by the extreme right or Tea Party people. It's by people we like to have dinner with. It's by people who can talk a good game. Lawrence Summers, right? I mean, I don't know. Robert Rubin. These people are the ones who really did more to mess up the economy than anyone. If you look at the crackdown on Occupy, which I do think was the most significant social movement, the political movement since the Civil Rights Movement, it seems to me it was cracked down on by liberal mayors, including in New York. I mean, they're the ones who call the cops. I remember speaking along with Robert Reich from here. We were at the L.A. Occupy. We had a wonderful teach-in, I think a week or two before Villaraigosa. A guy I knew, his mayor, cracked down on it. And I was there that night. I couldn't believe it. I mean, what was going on here? What was the great, and it's not like we don't have homeless people in L.A. That is downtown L.A., It's all one big encampment. This was actually the best spot. And so my question really is, where are the moderates? Where are the liberals? You're always going to have these other people. Now, I want to be positive, because I am not, the reason I am positive is I think the thing is not working. Mm-hmm. By the thing, I mean Imperial America. It's not working. And the breakdown of public schools, of income equality, of opportunity, creates discontent, and people know it. And I find it, I get in a lot of trouble, and if you go to Wikipedia, in my page, you'll see I am accused of having supported Rand and Ron Paul. Not quite true, but I have pointed out that Rand Paul does oppose the drones, and does oppose the Federal Reserve's, interesting little issue, it has nothing to do with our subject, I guess, but our Federal Reserve now gives $85 billion every month to help bankers. I would say banksters, and really, every month, it's not, we're going to argue about the budget now, we're going to close down the government, and who are the ones, people who objected to it? Ron Paul, who you probably think, many people here probably think is a outlier or a lunatic or what have you, but Ron Paul has been saying over again, why are they making these big decisions? Who elected them? Where does this money go? Why isn't there any give back? So I look at Elizabeth Warren on the other side. I look at people like, that who are really principled and stand for something. And so I see a movement in the society. I see movement away from the empire. I see a criticism of Wall Street and the oligarchy and all that was not there before. I see energy coming in where a collapsed labor movement is having some. And let's take California, which I think is the promised land right now. I think this is the bellwether for the nation. And look what happened in California. Suddenly, we had Prop 187, and they were going to, right? Demonize Latinos and immigrants, suddenly they're the most important voting bloc in the state. Southern California, which folks up here probably had contempt for, now is, right, makes the state solidly blue. Now, blue ain't always great, but it's a hell of a lot better than red. And we have fairly enlightened leadership in the state. And now Jerry Brown just signed off on about six different progressive measures. There's a second coming of Jerry. He's not the conservative he once was. So I actually don't want to go through another evening being depressed. I think we're going to win on privacy and on the surveillance state. I think it's against human nature. I don't think people want to be spied on. I don't think they want these things in their coats. I don't think they want Big Brother. And I think they will rebel against it. And our job is to get the information out that, this is not necessary to your security. It betrays your security. that a free people, I mean, after all, we have betrayed the basic idea of this country that freedom is not an indulgence. Freedom makes you stronger. Free expression drives out bad ideas. That's how you get to truth. And we have to take risks. We have to have open debate. And we lost that message. And I think if we stick to that, we're going to win. I do. And I'm so sorry you're not really a Raider fan.
I wanted to start by thanking both of you for being here this evening. And I found it extremely interesting, very informative, and I just deeply appreciate the work that you're doing. Thank you. Now, when I find myself in this kind of a unique situation to be able to actually talk to somebody such as yourself, I always like to ask one very specific question, and that is because you're so deeply focused on something that's so important that a lot of us don't have the time or the luxury or the ability to focus on. Your headlights extend much further into the darkness than we do. So we've been talking about stuff that's right now or right on the cusp of now, like the thumbprint for Apple, okay? But I know that you guys are aware of stuff or just beginning to see stuff on the horizon that we have no consciousness of. Can you help give us an idea of the things that you're starting to see, the things to start to pay attention to? What are you worrying about at nights? That kind of thing.
Well, I'm worried about the prison industrial complex very much. I'm worried about being able to mark people, trace them, demonize them, and is that the new Jim Crow? Yeah, I'm very aware of that, and it extends beyond racial identification, but of course the African-American community has been particularly hard hit. It's typing people from when they're 2 years old. It's treating them as throwaway children. My own son teaches in the Oakland schools here, and the abandonment of public schools. Frankly, I don't know if you ever read an autobiography of Colin Powell. Is a book I recommend to people. They think I'm crazy. But I happened to grow up two subway stops away from Colin Powell. He was in my class at City College of New York, a school that never thought of tuition at the time. And we actually had free textbooks to class, I think, before us. And when I think of how supportive our society in the Bronx was to us, and now when I look at the area around USC where I teach, and the breakdown of society, the breakdown of everything, the abandonment of, you know, this whole population we have, and the division with my friends even. Can you get to be a winner? Can you get into banking or something? You know, and when I think back, I mean, how recently the very idea of going to work for a bank was loathsome, right? It meant you were crude, you were greedy, or so forth. And I extend it even to religion. One reason I bring up the Pope, for instance, we lost even the restraint of what used to be mainline religion, you know, a concern for the other, right? The Good Samaritan tale of Luke or something. We've actually lost any notion of concern for the other, of accountability. And it scares me if we don't get that back. I guess if you want my real concern, it's a division into these two Americas. And if you look at the statistics on income and what's happened, I mean, the whole gain of the last, 8 years, of all the money we spent, the indebtedness as a society, right, it's almost all gone to that top 1%. It's astounding. I mean, if you want a prescription for disaster, if 8, 9 years ago, faced with this economic crisis, you said, what can we do to destroy America? Right? If somebody came along and said, I'm really subversive, I'm actually the Manchurian candidate, let me show you how to destroy America. Right? First, I'll create an economic crisis by totally deregulating the banks, right? Wall Street. I'll eliminate every significant regulation. I'll let greed run wild. They'll hustle people into homes. They'll package them in securities and sell them. All those things. So we'll come close to the Great Depression. And then, to get out of it, we'll make the banks whole. We'll make the rich people safe. We'll protect the 1%. They'll get all the gain. And we'll leave a society so severely divided as far as income that we have alienation as the norm. Right? Well, that's where we are now. It's truly frightening. It's truly subversive. And my only optimism is that most people will come to their senses and say, we can't go on like this. We have to think another way. And hopefully that will also include some people that I notice in California, to be pessimistic on this Prop 30. Marin County and Silicon Valley did vote for an increase in taxes to be able to support education. That may not be the revolution, but it's a step in the right direction that, you know, even rich people can't go live on some goddamn island somewhere, and they got to make this place work.
Thank you. I would just add, with all of that is we are such a punishing country. The sentences we mete out to individuals who have broken the law, life plus 100 years, other countries look at us and we've lost the sense that punishment or going to, say, a correctional facility should be to rehabilitate. It doesn't. It makes people more perhaps inclined toward more criminal acts. But I go to visit Mumia Abu-Jamal in prison maybe every 6 weeks. And I see now he's in general population because he was moved off of death row about almost 2 years ago. But the families in the visiting room, these beautiful, mostly men of color, it's just tragic. And when you read about what's now called the school-to-prison pipeline, the harsh ways that children are being punished for being children, for maybe acting out. They're handcuffed, they're taken in, they're arrested, and it changes their lives. And how did we as a society get to this point? So I think that frightens me because I see options being cut off for young children and a society that seems to have lost its common sense. So I think that punishment and everything that Robert mentioned, along with the prospect of a potential national identification program, that prospect frightens me. But I do think we can fight that.